Friday, April 2nd. Shiro Shinobi Arena was packed and roaring on the first day of the Major League Bending regular season, much more so than it had been for the exhibition game Utrina had caught, and Corwin had found himself playing in, a couple of weeks ago. There had been a good crowd on hand for that, but tonight the place was absolutely rammed. Standing room only, and not much of that, and there was a whole different intensity to the energy in the room. It reminded Utrina of nothing so much as the Toronto Raider Dome, just before Game 7 of the 2404 World Series. Here at the other end of the season, the excitement was all about potential, not ultimate outcomes, but the level of it was about the same. She reflected on that day as she and Corwin made their way to their seats. That was, she was faintly shocked to realize, before she met him. Nowadays, she often had trouble imagining that there had been such a time, but there it was. There'd been two whole terms, half a school year, when, apart from Megazone, she knew no one at all in Midgard outside of WPI. Utrina didn't much like to look back at those days. In many ways, they had been the darkest of her life. True, they'd contained the seeds of her eventual deliverance, but she hadn't known that at the time. Apart from a few bright and precious moments, she'd only known the heartbreak until Christmas time. Game 7 had been one of those moments. In fact, the whole Toronto trip had been stuffed with them, and she had no qualms about calling it to mind now. They weren't heading for the bleachers this time, but down front, to one of the courtside boxes where the season ticket holders sat. This was much like being in the regular stands. They were still down in the great bowl of the arena, in the thick of it all, but with better seats and smartly uniformed waiters to handle concession runs. Utrina approved of this arrangement, and it was with a smile that was part nostalgia and part plain enjoyment of the occasion that she took the seat Minami Sato was holding for her down front. "Evening, Prince Tenjo," said Ryo with a courtly bow from the far side of his sister. "You're looking divine as always." Utrina thought that was pushing the boat out a little, since she was dressed in nothing fancier than some old Martian Army cargo shorts and Corwin's Karasu 99 fire ferret sweater, which served her fairly well as an overcoat. But she smiled and thanked him graciously all the same. It was hard not to be gracious with Ryo, even when his charm was a little over the top, because it was always done with such deliberate, self-mocking wryness. Not irony, exactly, that would have been tedious, but with a winking acknowledgement that he couldn't help being a little silly. He reminded her slightly of Devlin Carter, with whom, she suspected, he would probably get on like a house afire. Corwin slipped into his own seat beside her, checking his watch as he did so. Just in time for the pregame show, he said, powering up his Omni-tool. "Ooh, what's that?" Minami inquired eagerly, leaning across Utrina to get a better look. "I'll show you later," Corwin said, waving her back to her seat. "I bet you will," said Utrina, elbowing him. Corwin gave her a Vulcan-style, "I beg your pardon," eyebrow, which got giggles out of both the women to his right, and then went back to what he was doing. A moment later, the tool's holographic interface fell back to passive mode, and the audio feed from the Republic Television Network gently overlaid the rest of the sounds around them. "To MLB on RTN, I'm Hitomi Hattori. With me as always is ace earthbender and two-time Western League MVP, Kuo Ren Lee." "Always a pleasure." "And on my right, joining us here for opening day at Shiro Shinobi Arena, a guest I'm sure requires no introduction. Welcome back to the press box, Avatar Korra." "Thanks, Hitomi. Good to be back. How was your off-season?" Corwin sat back in his seat and smiled, listening to Korra chat and banter with the two regular commentators. He'd always enjoyed watching and or hearing her work a room, be it just a couple of people in a broadcast booth, or, on one memorable occasion, the United Republic Senate. "How come you're not pulling in the video feed, too?" Utrina wondered, leaning to murmur in his ear. Do you really want me to have to explain how I'm doing that to Minami right here and now while she sits in your lap? Corwin replied dryly. Because that's what happens when I bust out the full-motion holograms, telling you right now. Good point. I guess we'd better skip that for right now. I wouldn't mind so much, she added with a mischievous grin. But Ryo might be embarrassed. You're in a playful mood tonight, said Corwin with a wry little smile. Why shouldn't I be? Utrina replied with a carefree toss of her hair. It's Friday. Most citizens of Republic City would probably have been surprised to learn that there was even one television on Air Temple Island. Such was the Air Nomad's reputation for reflective and scholarly pursuits that many people assumed such a thing would be strictly forbidden in their central enclave. It seemed like entirely too worldly a thing for them to be on board with. In fact, there were two TV sets on the island. The smaller of the two belonged to Master Milo and wasn't connected to an antenna. He affected to disdain broadcast programming and used his personal set only to watch old action films, the world's most extensive collection of which he happened to own on mover disc. Sometimes one or more of his siblings or Cora would watch with him, and on rare occasions he might invite a favored student or two to join the viewing audience. But for the most part, this was a solitary pursuit, which Milo insisted was a form of meditation, not that anyone believed him. The other stood in one corner of the large room at the end of the downstairs corridor of the ladies' quarters annex, which, since time almost immemorial, had been Avatar Korra's study. It was there, rather than in her small, Spartan bedroom on the second floor, where she received official visitors. There that she maintained most of her extensive personal library, and there where she had written the bulk of most of the several books to her credit. So it was there, at around 7 o'clock, that those denizens of the island who were interested in Major League bending gathered to watch the 24-10 season opener. There were normally just a couple of armchairs in the part of the room that wasn't given over to Korra's desk, but it was a simple matter for Iki and Nima to haul in a sofa from the common room and rearrange things accordingly. Now they, Anthy, with Garnet and Annabelle, naturally, Milo, and a handful of the youngsters all arranged themselves with snacks and beverages to hand, preparing for game time. After the flashy MLB on RTN introductory title graphics, the first view they were all treated to was a long-lens shot of the press box overlooking the court, taken by one of the cameras whose normal job was to show the action itself. There, through the opened windows, three cheerful figures could be seen sitting at the lower deck commentary desk, surrounded by monitors and microphones, each wearing a pair of bulky studio headphones. Despite the paraphernalia, all were smartly dressed. Good evening, bending fans, and welcome to MLB on RTN, said the smiling young woman in the middle. I'm Hitomi Hattori. With me, as always, is ace earthbender and two-time Western League MVP, Kuo Ren Lee. Always a pleasure, said the green-clad, middle-aged figure to her left with a beaming grin. And on my right, joining us here for opening day at Shiro Shinobi Arena, a guest I'm sure requires no introduction, said Hitomi. Welcome back to the press box, Avatar Korra. Korra, neat and tidy in her best double-breasted tunic and high opera gloves, but looking cool and relaxed with Pabu the 17th and his team jacket on her shoulder, returned the play-by-play woman's smile and replied, Thanks, Hitomi. Good to be back. How was your off-season? She didn't introduce Pabu. Garnet mused. That's just rude. To be fair, he probably isn't going to have much to offer in the way of commentary, Iki observed as she settled herself on the couch to Anthy's right. Milo nodded agreement, assuming his traditional place, stretched out face down on the floor in front of the couch, chin propped on hands like a little boy. His understanding of the mechanics of the game is sketchy at best, he said. Do you have everything you need, Anthy? Asked Nima. I'm fine, Nima. Do sit down, said Anthy, patting the cushion to her left. You know, said Sita thoughtfully from the sofa arm next to Iki, if I had two husbands, and they both left me at home with the baby while they went to a game, I don't think I'd be so cheerful. In front of the couch, Tenzin and Gyatso glanced at each other, then ostentatiously looked away, drawing a little snort of laughter from Garnet. It's traditional, Anthy told her, smiling cheerfully past Iki at the young air acolyte. Friday evenings have been Corwin and Utina's time to themselves since long before Annabelle came along. Settling back, she turned the smile to her infant daughter and added, as if to her, although I did have to remind them of that fact before I could convince them to go tonight. Just before the start of the first supporting match, the group in the Sato's box seats was joined by a couple of late-arriving figures, excuse-me-ing their way down the row from the aisle. Both Nall and Lokpa looked a bit awkward, as if neither were entirely certain of the welcome they could expect. Lokpa, in particular, hung back a bit and only reluctantly met Corwin's eyes. For his part, though, Corwin was determined not to be the one to bring the occasion down, and he greeted her pleasantly enough. And Utina surprised Nall by rising and edging past her husband to give him a full and proper hug. We miss you, she told him quietly. I hope you're finding what you need. If there's anything we can do... Thanks, said Nall, returning the embrace. I'll let you know. Honest. Right now, we're working on it. Utina let him go, stepped back, and gave him a slightly sad smile, then reached past him and tagged Lokpa's shoulder before returning to her seat. Still looking mildly sheepish, Nall took the seat next to Corwin, with Lokpa on the other side of him. Nothing more was said of the matter, because within moments the PA crackled to life and the pre-game ceremonies commenced. By tacit agreement, the four put other considerations aside for the duration and concentrated on having a good time, which they proceeded to do, without reservation. Saturday, April 3rd. The next morning, no one was very surprised to find that the Tribune's Section 4 lead photo showed Cora, Corwin, and Utina during the final round of the previous evening's headline match, caught in an instant that had been immortalized on TV the night before. As the Fire Ferret's team principal, Cora had recused herself from commentary on the final bout, reporting instead to the stands to take it in with the others in the Sato's courtside box. Given that full opening day crowd management protocols were in effect already, the hat was not required. The photograph in question showed her seated, still with Pabu on her shoulder, between Corwin and Utina. Or at least she would have been seated between them if there had been room for that. Since they were in the box seats and not the bleachers, however, and since the arena had been absolutely jam-packed when she arrived, she was actually more sort of perched on the shared armrest between their seats. In the moment captured in the picture, she had her left hand on Corwin's head for stability, her spread fingers pressing furrows into his unruly black hair, and was pointing at something on the court with her other hand. Corwin was giving her an amused, sidelong, yes, sort of look, while both Cora and Utina were shouting at someone out of shot, both their faces showing comically similar irritation. They were, if Corwin recalled correctly, both yelling at the ref about a call with which neither had agreed. It was the kind of snapshot Section 4 would have had a bit of a field day with, not so long before, given that Cora was practically sitting in Corwin's lap and his wife was right there next to her, evidently agreeing with whatever sentiment she was voicing. The copy beneath, however, was much more circumspect than it would have been a couple of weeks before. Section 4's editor, it appeared, had taken his chastisement to heart, and the section was now at pains not to speculate about anything. The article merely noted that the Avatar and friends had appeared to enjoy the game very much, and left it at that. "Well, there," said Korra with an air of satisfaction. "Maybe Chiang's finally got that guy trained." She regarded the picture thoughtfully for a second, then took out her gear phone and dialed. "Hey, Chiang." "Yeah, that's a lot better. Nice work. Listen, can you score a good print of the photo from today's? We'll send it to Kate. Thanks." She paused, listening. "Yep, as soon as we're done with breakfast." "Right. Okay. Thanks." Closing the phone, she grinned around the table, then said, "Okay, you guys about ready? Minami should be here any minute." "You're awfully chipper for 7:45 in the morning," Corwin observed dryly as he, Korra, Utena, and Anthy, the last with Annabelle aboard and Garnet and Makoto flying alongside, left the dining hall. Korra shrugged, still grinning. "I'm on vacation," she said. "Trying to figure out how long it's been since I was last in my old hometown. Glacier Spirits the year before last, I think. I didn't even make it for my own birthday last year because of White Lotus shenanigans." She looked momentarily annoyed, her jaw threatening to jut pugnaciously, and then shook it off and grinned again. "But not this time," she added, then put thumb and little finger to the corners of her mouth and whistled. Neri came bounding across the courtyard at her call, already saddled up and sporting a pair of bulky leather panniers. Korra caught hold of the polar bear dog's harness as she approached and swung with practiced ease into the saddle, then leaned forward to scruffle her ears, remarking, "You can't wait to get home either, can you, girl?" At the pier, they found a small mound of luggage and a little group of air nomads waiting for them. Utena, who was still getting used to Grandmaster Jinora's slightly mercurial moods, was a little bemused at the formality of her send-off. A person would think they were going away for a year or more, not 20 days. But Anthy received it with equal gravity, leavened only by the slightly conspiratorial twinkle in both women's eyes as they exchanged airbender bows. "Vayu and I are off today as well. We have business at the Southern Air Temple," Nima told them after her own round of bows. "We'll meet you in Senna for the festival." "Sounds like a plan," said Utena with a grin. "Does this mean it's time for you to start getting your nomad on?" "Not quite yet," said Nima, shaking her head. With a hard-to-read little smiling glance at her great-grandmother, she added, "This is more of an errand." "Well, I guess all we need now is the guest of honor," said Korra wryly. "And we can..." She was interrupted by the cry of a steam whistle as a sleek, low-slung launch swept around the point and into the harbor, speeding up to the quayside with a merry chuffing and a streamer of white smoke from its one rakishly angled stack. At the controls, Minami Sato gave a big overhead wave as she drew alongside, expertly throttling back so that the boat slid gracefully to a halt in the right place. "Ahoy, travelers!" she cried as Tenzin and Gyatso scrambled to tie up the launch. "Is everyone ready to go? Adventure awaits on the high seas." The four additional adults, polar bear dog, and luggage made for a fairly tight squeeze in the launch's cockpit, and though Corwin was pleased to see the boat again, he had pleasant memories of a years-ago coastal trip with Minami and Ryo aboard this very vessel, the Sato clan's ancestral steam launch, Agni 6. He was also looking a little dubious as they cast off and pulled away from the pier with another cheery blast of the whistle. "If you don't mind my saying so, Minami," he observed, "the Agni 6 seems a little small for our purposes today." Minami laughed. "What's the matter, Corbin? Not up for a 7,000-mile ocean voyage in a 25-foot open boat with 7 of your best friends?" Before he could answer, she went on, "Not to worry, this is only a short trip. then swept the launch into a long arc around the southern tip of Air Temple Island. As they cleared the headland, their destination swung into view, and Minami couldn't keep a grin from spreading across her face. It was a ship, sleek and purposeful-looking, with a sharp bow flowing back with a graceful curve to a square stern. Utena, considering her with the eye of an enthusiast of such matters, marked her just a bit longer than the Valiant, stem to stern, around 420 feet. For about half her length, starting just abaft the tallest part of the superstructure, the hull broadened into a trimaran configuration, with a slim and graceful sponson riding on either side of the narrow central hull before they merged some way above the waterline. Hull and superstructure were both smoothly finished, with many flush-fitted windows. The whole area abaft the bridge seemed to be glazed, almost like a greenhouse, and few of the exposed griblies customary on the other large surface ships Utena had seen at Republic City's docks. Though evidently unarmed and painted a clean, shining white above the plimsoll line, and bright scarlet below, she had the unmistakably lean and aggressive look of a warship about her, and what appeared to be a flight deck, spreading out to the full width of the trimaran hull section abaft the superstructure. Her grin widening further, Minami steered the Agni 6 around to the bigger vessel's stern, where a large, barn door-like hatch stood open in the hull plating. Extended from this and awaiting them was an elaborate mechanical contraption which, Utena realized as they approached it, was a sort of davit. Below the opening, bold Kokugo and standard characters spelled out the ship's name and home port. MV Mirai, Future City. Seeing this, Corwin laughed. Minami gave him a querying glance as she expertly steered the Agni 6 into the space beneath the arms of the davit. "I have a cousin called Mirai on my mother's side," he explained. "Oh," said Minami. "Right, I remember you mentioned her at grandmother's funeral. That's who this one's named after." Corwin nodded. "I figured." As the davit crew squared away the launch, one of them placed a gangway for the boat party to disembark by. Minami gestured her guests across, then stepped lightly over herself, offering her thanks to the crew as she did so. Briskly and efficiently, they set to securing the Agni 6 in a permanent berth off to one side. They were on a catwalk halfway up one side wall of a cavernous room, the full width of the triple hull and a good 2 stories high. Part cargo hold, part hangar deck, part Utena wasn't really sure what. Up forward, an autogyro stood with its rotors folded on a giant elevator platform, ready to be lifted to deck level. The ceiling was crisscrossed with tracked cranes, reminding her of the big rooms in Corwin's underground workshop in New Avalon. A couple of big rectangular objects, like shipping containers but of an unfamiliar size, were secured to the sprawling floor with spacious aisles between them, like houses in a miniature neighborhood. With an expansive gesture that took it all in, Minami declared with a wry little grin, "Welcome aboard my little boat. If you'll follow me, I'll give you the tour. Don't worry about your things, the crew will take care of everything." "This is a yacht?" Utena inquired, as Minami led them along the catwalk toward a hatch in the forward bulkhead. "She looks more like a warship." "She is a warship," said Minami. "Or, well, she's meant to be. The Mirai is a prototype. The first of a new class of coastal patrol frigate we're hoping will be the next big thing in maritime security." Utena thought that over for a second, then wondered, "Security from what? I mean, in a world with only 6 countries. "Pirates," Cora put in. "Remember when we first met, I mentioned why we missed connections when you guys were on Zipang last year?" Minami nodded. "Pirates, commerce raiders, and other rogue actors. The 6 nations are at peace right now, and have been for quite some time, thanks to the diligence of our avatar, she added with an overcooked bow that got a blushing grin and a dismissive wave from Cora. But there are a lot of little islands in the Mosei and the archipelago of the Eastern Fire Nation. Every now and again, some loon bat will get the idea to set up a little renegade kingdom out there and start picking off freighters in the straits. The Fire Navy and the United Forces do what they can, but there's not a lot of room to maneuver among those islands. That's where the Mirai class comes in. They're fast, agile, flexibly configurable, and economical to operate, but powerful enough to make any would-be pirate prince think twice about his career plans. So that'd be the sales pitch, then, said Garnet. Minami grinned. Of course, she said. You're not the first tour group I've explained all this to. We used the prototype as a demonstrator until we got our first order from the United Forces. They requested a few changes, so the production vessels are slightly different. Different enough that we use the first of those as the demonstration ship now. That left the Mirai at a bit of a loose end, so I had her refitted as an... She paused, both to consider her phrasing and to hold the hatch for her guests, then stepped through it behind them, closed it, and led the way up the passage. Executive transport, she concluded. The corridor they were in now was considerably less utilitarian than the hold cum hangar deck they'd just left. It was carpeted, for one thing, and featured tasteful wood paneling on the walls. The lighting was bright but cheerful, not harsh or industrial. Remind me to become an executive, Garnet quipped as Minami led the party down a transverse corridor and into a beautifully decorated area that put them in mind of a stately home's great hall, complete with grand staircase. It has its perks, Minami told the little dragon, but it's more work than you might think. In this form, the Mirai still demonstrates what this hull design can do, but heads of state and government ministers tend to find this configuration more attractive than the military version, she added with a wink. So she's not just a toy, and she's not the biggest yacht in the world, believe it or not. Some insane Earth Kingdom Genomite mine owner has that honor. His is something like 600 feet long. I saw an article about it in Life at Sea magazine once. She made a face. Ghastly. The tour took nearly a quarter of an hour, during which time Minami showed them what amounted to a miniaturized version of the amenities one might have found on one of the great Atlantic liners of 20th century Earth. Utina knew this because Griffin had a mild fascination with the subject, and several large books in his library back in New Avalon concerned them. The decor was a little sleeker and more modern, admittedly, but the attention to detail and the unashamed luxury of it all were very similar. Everything was presented with style and taste, no expense spared, but none wasted either. This was a pleasure cruiser with a purpose, Sato style. They touched briefly on the game room, library, dining room, and other shared amenities. There was a dojo, naturally, as well as a full-service banya, before taking a quick swing through the spacious, well-equipped staterooms and then up to the bridge. This was a more business-like space, but still beautifully appointed, its every fixture gleaming. There were four people on duty, two officers, a comms operator, and a helmswoman. Minami introduced her guests graciously to all four personnel. Captain Xiao Bai, a compact, gray-haired woman. Her executive officer, First Lieutenant Zhi, a tall, thin, humorless-looking middle-aged man. Red-faced and cheerful radio man Harbin. And petite, smiling Quartermaster Yumi.
It is a great honor to have you traveling with us, Avatar.
Lieutenant G barked stiffly before anyone else had a chance to speak. Slightly to Utina's surprise, and to her immediate approval, Yumi didn't even bother to suppress a giggle at the officer's stone-faced seriousness. He shot her a millisecond glare, but otherwise said and did nothing about it. Anthy could have sworn she saw the captain hide a little smile behind one white-gloved hand, while Cora, her own amusement ill-concealed but faintly apologetic, assured him that the honor was hers. Well, what do you say, Captain? Minami inquired. Shall we get underway?
Aye, aye, Miss Sato, said the captain briskly. Mr. G, prepare to weigh anchor. Destination Kyoshi Island.
Come along, all, said Minami. I still have one more surprise for you while we let these folks work.
So saying, she led them back to the short corridor that ran athwartships abaft the bridge, but instead of taking them back to the companionway down into the quarters area, she led them up a narrow staircase to the uppermost level of the superstructure. Here there were two hatches. One led forward and was labeled Communications Room, while the other, unmarked, faced aft.
Minami grinned and opened the latter, gesturing her guests through ahead of her. The spacious room beyond was filled with sunshine, like the sun parlor of Tenzin's house. It was the glassed-in, greenhouse-like area Utena had noticed from the Agni Six. Despite the bright light, however, it was not baking hot like a greenhouse would have been under skies this clear. The glass had just enough of a tint in it to cut the glare and block out the heat, making for a lovely, cool, welcoming space. One of the windows on the after wall, they saw, was actually a sliding door, leading out onto a little railed-off promenade deck, overlooking the flight deck. The view, unsurprisingly, was spectacular, particularly right now, with Air Temple Island, Aang Island, and the Republic City skyline still filling the horizon beyond the ship's creamy wake. To everyone's surprise, the solarium was configured like the sun parlor of Tenzin's house, too. From the comfortable grouping of furniture arranged next to the entrance, to the design desk station and architect's table at the far end, positioned for the optimal view of the sea.
Voila, said Minami with a beaming smile. All the comforts of home and then some.
Cora blinked at the reproduction of the Mount Weitang project office, then turned to her and said,
Minami, we...
Yes, Cora, I know you plan to put the project on hold for the duration, but I know you, said Minami with an indulgent smile, and Corwin. Lounge around and do nothing for nearly 3 weeks? I think we all know that was never going to work. Everyone laughed at that, and at the comically hangdog look on Cora's face as she admitted that Minami probably had a point. Dinner on the first night out demonstrated that the food aboard the Mirai, like all the other amenities, was first rate. Unlike many rich people, Minami did not generally employ a personal chef. But for voyages that would involve dignitaries coming aboard, she was in the habit of arranging for a senior kitchen staffer from one or another of Republic City's finest restaurants to join the yacht's crew as a contractor. On this particular trip, the individual in question was normally the sous chef of the Phoenix House, and she seemed to be relishing the opportunity to run off the chain for a couple of weeks, flexing culinary muscles usually left unflexed in the Phoenix House's renowned but rather tradition-bound kitchen. Her offerings, delivered to the owner's table in the ship's small but magnificently appointed dining room by smartly uniformed stewards, were spectacular, and, unlike everything available on Air Temple Island, they involved quite a lot of meat. The inevitable result on that first night was a scene of carnage that would have terrified passers-by if there'd been any, as four carnivorous people who had been living on that vegetarian island for weeks reacquainted themselves with their old friend animal protein with what could fairly be described as a vengeance. Even Minami, who had been sort of expecting it, was slightly agog at the spectacle. An hour or so after dinner, up on the top deck, Utena, almost by accident, made an astonishing discovery. While Cora and Corwin made certain all the drawings and files they needed were aboard, either physically or electronically, and generally reoriented themselves to their new working environment, Minami relaxed in an armchair with a fruity beverage, and Anthe read a passage from Avatar Yangchen's memoirs to Annabelle, Garnet, and Makoto, who gave every impression of closely attending. She went out onto the miniature promenade deck abaft the solarium. Once there, with the door shut behind her, she leaned on the rail, took a deep, blissful, eyes-closed breath of the cool sea air, and then opened her eyes and saw the sky. "Oh, wow," she breathed, gazing in wonderment at the celestial show above her. Out here, far out of sight of land, in a world with air as clear, despite the well-established industrialization of the 3rd century, as Dee chose, and with the light of the room behind her largely contained by the tinted glass, the seeing was spectacular. In fact, it was probably the best she'd ever encountered, in several years now as an avid amateur astronomer, and the blue-black sky above her was practically ablaze with starlight. Yue had not yet risen, and would be but a crescent when she did, but Utina could still make out the details of her rose crest ring. She thought she might almost have been able to read if the print were large enough. Turning back to the solarium, she opened the sliding door partway and said quietly, "Hey, you guys, you have to come and see this." With expressions ranging from interested to faintly quizzical, the others all put aside what they were doing and joined her out on the promenade deck. It was just slightly crowded with all of them out there, but not uncomfortably so, and with the door shut behind them, they could instantly see what she was getting at. Cora grinned broadly, her teeth glinting in the starlight. "Good, eh?" she said, then winked. "Wait till you see the southern lights." Utina smiled and turned back to considering the sky. "The constellations are different here," she observed after a few moments. "I wish I'd thought to buy a planisphere before we left Republic City." "Hmm," said Minami thoughtfully. "One second." As with most of the doors on the ship, there was a small intercom panel set into the frame around the one leading back into the solarium. She went to it now and pressed the topmost in the row of call buttons. "Bridge, 3rd Officer Han, said a man's voice after a moment. "Mr. Han, would you please pass the word for Mr. Ji?" said Minami pleasantly. "He's needed on the promenade deck with his navigation instruments." "Aye, aye, Miss Sato," said Han at once. Minami thanked him, switched off the intercom, and then turned a mischievous smile to the others. "It's good to be the Commodore." 1st Officer Ji arrived only a minute or two later, perfectly pressed despite the hour, carrying a black leather case and looking a little bit puzzled. By this time, everyone else had resumed their activities inside. At his entrance, Minami smiled over her fruity drink and said, "Mr. Ji, would you be kind enough to share some of your celestial knowledge with Commodore Tencho? She's an experienced sailor in her own right, but..." Here she smiled a little slyly, shooting Corwin a wink. "Not under our sky." Ji continued to look confused for a second or so longer, then finished parsing the request and smiled, suddenly looking much more human than he had when shouting rigidly formal greetings to the Avatar on the bridge. "It'd be my pleasure, Miss Sato," he said, and then reported to the promenade deck to do as he was asked. It would take the Mirai 5 days at her very impressive top speed to cover the 5,000 or so sea miles between Republic City and Kyoshi Island, her only planned stop on the way to Nanisivik. In that time, Annabelle's parents discovered to their delight that their daughter was evidently a natural traveler. To be sure, sea conditions were reasonably calm throughout the voyage, and the ship's trimaran hull and advanced stabilizers made for a very smooth ride. But all the same, Corwin, at least, had harbored a few concerns, and it appeared that they were quite unfounded. The travelers quickly found themselves settling into a shipboard routine very much like the one they'd enjoyed on Air Temple Island, dividing their time between recreational activities, athletic pursuits, family togetherness, and, for Corwin and Cora, unexpectedly continued diligence on the Mount Weitang project. Thanks to the Mirai's sophisticated communications equipment, not only was Minami able to stay on top of all the various business and technical concerns which she was unable to put aside for the duration of the trip, the Mountain House's architect and engineer could keep in touch with their self-appointed site supervisor, who reported that everything was going extremely well. On pleasant days, which was most of them, as they plied the warm waters of the tropics, Utena and Korra did their training and sparring out on the flight deck rather than shutting themselves up below decks in the ship's modular dojo. So too did Anthy and, in the absence of Nima, Corwin. Even Minami occasionally pried herself away from the heavy work of running Future Industries remotely to keep her edges sharp with the others. She was not in any sense a professional martial artist, but like many of her illustrious ancestors, she took pride in her ability to defend herself. For their part, Makoto and Garnet discovered to their chagrin that a 45-knot headwind is a challenging environment in which to frolic aerially, and quickly arrived at the nonverbal consensus that they probably ought to confine themselves to more sedentary pursuits when not below. And Neri, well, Neri caught up on her sleep. If prior visits to the South Pole were anything to go by, she was likely to need as much of a reserve as possible once they arrived. In the evenings, and evening came suddenly at sea, they followed much the same pattern as on shore. After supper, Corwin and Cora would generally retire to the project office, where, with the lights low to minimize glare on the windows, they worked into the night on the collaborative parts of the project. Often, one or more of their fellow travelers would join them there, reading or playing quiet games. On clear nights, Utena spent much of her time out on the promenade deck, with Lieutenant G's borrowed planisphere and octant, leading Cora to joke that they might need to turn the hose on her to dislodge her from her perch. The first exception to this pattern was Monday evening, when the Mirai passed through a band of heavy tropical rain. This kept everyone inside, and the Tenjos decided to make an early night of it, leaving Corwin and Cora to their work. They, in turn, passed a quiet and productive evening in the office with smooth jazz turned down low on the shortwave, punctuated occasionally by the chimes of the Earth Kingdom Radio standard time signal, all underlaid by the drumming of the rain on the ceiling above them. Speaking little, they worked unhurriedly but steadily, enjoying the opportunity to sink fully into the groove without having to ignore anyone in the process. By 1:30 or so on what was technically Tuesday morning, Corwin had reached the stage of the proceedings where his eyelids were heavy and felt somewhat as if their interior surfaces had been lightly sanded, like a road in winter. These, and a mild but escalating difficulty in focusing on what he was doing, were clear warning signs that he ought to head for bed, or at least take a break and get something to drink, but he did his best to ignore them for the moment. He was still bent on finishing the perspective sketch he was working on, which he was sure would convey the grandeur he was envisioning for the house's main room if he could just get it done. And besides, this had been such a perfect evening that he was loath to admit it was over just yet. In this state, he was increasingly susceptible to distraction, and not always from sources that were immediately obvious. Right now, for instance, he kept catching movement out of the corner of his eye. It wasn't a surprise that this was happening. Cora was over there, just outside his conscious field of view, bent over her drafting table and engaged in a review of the structural diagrams for the west wing of the house. Normally, he could tune her out and get on with his own work, but in his present condition, this was becoming harder and harder. Eventually, without really registering the change, he'd put down his stylus and turned to see exactly what it was that kept tripping his motion sensor. This turned out to be Cora's hair, specifically her ponytail. It moved whenever she did, swinging a concordant angle as she turned her head to look from one side of the drawing she was reviewing to the other. Now that he'd turned to take direct note of it, Corwin found himself oddly fascinated by the physics involved, the interaction of gravity, mass, and inertia, the way thousands of individual strands could and did function as a single body. He watched with silent absorption for perhaps 2 minutes, until she stopped moving to focus on a particular small detail of the drawing for an extended moment. While some small, detached part of him watched in bemusement, Corwin found himself rolling his chair a little closer, reaching out, and batting at her ponytail like a cat to break up its unsatisfying stillness. Startled by this sudden, unwarranted liveliness on the part of her hair, Cora paused, then turned to look back over her shoulder and inquire archly, yes? Sorry, Corwin replied. Getting punchy. It stopped moving, you see, he said, returning enough from his reverie as he said it to realize how ridiculous it sounded. Cora was pretty tired herself by that point, though, and she seemed to understand. Ah, she said, nodding, and when she turned back to her work, it was with a little extra something that made her ponytail flick almost completely sideways before describing an arc back to its usual rest position. Well, now you're just showing off, Corbin mock grumped. He turned back to the design desk, but his momentum was broken now. And besides, he saw with his newly unzombified eyes that he hadn't made any progress in the last few minutes, that he wouldn't just have to do over again after he'd had some sleep anyway. Sighing, he saved the file, switched the console to sleep mode, and then got down from his stool and went to look over Cora's shoulder. Calling it a day? She wondered without looking up, making a small measurement. Yeah, I think so, Corwin said, then admitted. I just corrected the same angle at least 3 times. That's not getting me anywhere. Well, I'm not far behind you, Cora conceded, putting down her pencil and straightening her back with a mild crack and a satisfied grunt. Just want to clean this up a little more. Corwin looked. Is this the second floor? Mm-hmm. The part that'll hold up the west wing deck, said Cora. She picked up her pencil again and used it to point out the place where the structural members changed direction, running north-south in the main house and east-west in the west wing. Corwin nodded. Looks good. He considered something for a second, regarding Cora's profile with a thoughtful look, then said, Hey, Cora? Hmm? She replied, still focused mostly on the drawing. Would you do something for me? Cora turned to give him a questioning look. What? Take it down for a minute? Corwin asked. When she looked puzzled, he explained, Just in back, if you want. It's just, you've had that same hairstyle ever since I can remember. That or the formal version with the little... He gestured vaguely with his hand cupped at the back of his head. Cap thing. I'm not sure I've ever seen you with it all the way down. Usually that means something really bad is happening, Cora said dryly. But... Okay. She put her pencil down again, reached up with both hands and let down her ponytail, then gave her head a shake. With the tie removed, her thick, dark brown hair fell naturally around her shoulders and down her back. It was long enough to reach the middle of her back, between her pronounced shoulder blades, and probably as far in front if her still-tied side locks hadn't been in the way. The effect was to make her look not older exactly, but slightly more mature than she usually did, in a casual and unstudied way that was not unlike Utina's usual style. It also, along with the mild blush that rose slowly in her face as Corwin regarded her, gave her an unusual air of vulnerability, if only because she was so obviously unaccustomed to anyone seeing her that way, and he found that curiously appealing. He said pensively. Then he smiled his boyish, tired smile and declared, Nice. Then, his curiosity satisfied, He turned back to the drawing she'd been correcting and said,
"So these manufactured floor joists, what kind of span can we get out of them before we have to start cross-bracing?"
Cora blinked in surprise at the question, then shook her head again to regain her focus and answered,
"Well, it depends on which grade we get. There are 3 or 4 different ones."
The next day, all appeared to have returned to normal. Corwin and Cora didn't actually see each other again until dinner time, what with the various other things they had to do during the day. And after the meal, they returned to the field office and picked up where they'd left off without a missed beat. Neither mentioned the curious incident of the hair in the nighttime again, because neither thought it especially needed or merited mentioning. It was just an odd, pleasant little moment has come along sometimes. At least, that was how both interpreted it and filed it. But below the surface, something had begun very slowly to change at that moment. Without consciously realizing it, Cora began dialing back her expressions of affection with Corwin thereafter. From that point on, she would often pause fractionally before some easy intimacy, and then substitute a lesser gesture in its place. A kiss became a hug an arm over his shoulders, then an arm over his shoulders became a hand on his forearm. She didn't touch him as often, nor for as long, nor in quite such artlessly personal places as before. She had never taken serious liberties, but now she began refraining from taking even casual ones. Part of this was simply a cooling of the intensity that had come with their long-delayed reunion, a natural diminution of the need to make up for lost time as both became confident that the long break in their relationship would not be repeated. But another, larger, more insistent part of it was Cora's developing awareness, at this stage barely liminal, of Corwin not only as a bigger, stronger version of her buddy of old, though he was still that, but as a man, full stop. There was a growing cognitive dissonance there that she wasn't ready to think about out loud just yet, and even if she did, it would only be to deem it inappropriate on several levels. So she kept herself away from it, unconsciously editing herself, substituting a series of small, easily overlooked awkwardnesses for one big, unmissable one. Easily overlooked by herself and Corbin, at least, but not by Anthy. It had been plain to her from very early on that the Avatar was a very physical sort of person, in her demonstrations of affection as in most everything else. Besides which, Anthy was peculiarly well equipped to detect such small awkwardnesses, where others might miss them. The realization came to her gradually, but plainly, and by the time they stopped for fuel at Kyoshi Island, she had begun seriously to consider what she might do about it. Thursday, April 8th, Port Tsuki, Kyoshi Island. Modernity came slowly to Kyoshi Island, partly by chance and partly by choice. The islanders had always been an independent, stubborn bunch, an artifact of the island's eventful origins, no doubt, and the guiding spirit of its namesake and patroness, Avatar Kyoshi. And they had very deliberately chosen which aspects of the post-war brave new world they would embrace, and which they would reject. So it was that the traditional agricultural and aquacultural economy was still in force, and the way of life not so very different from the way it had been in Kyoshi's own day. Sure, pretty much every family had a radio. Indeed, nowadays, most of them had a television. But there were virtually no cars on the island, and the fishermen and women still did their work largely by hand. In one of the island's few concessions to the 3rd century, one of its several seaports did have a modern port facility. This was for the convenience of ocean-going vessels, many of whose routes brought them conveniently near Kyoshi Island and made it a natural place to stop for fuel and provisions. The boost this provided to the local economy was graciously accepted by most of the locals, so long as the machinery and noise could be confined to one rocky corner of their island. Port Tsuki, named for one of the heroes of the Hundred-Year War, was that corner. Today, with no scheduled commercial traffic, no liners of the Earth Kingdom Line, United Republic freight ships, or tankers from Allied Oil or the Chameleon Bay Company passing through, the seaport was quiet. The Mirai had no competition for berthing space, nor a queue to join for fuel, as she rounded the headland and steamed into the harbor. Commander Maki of the Kyoshi Warriors was waiting on the quayside as the vessel tied up, dressed in civvies and carrying a bulging duffel bag. Once the complicated business of making port was accomplished and the fueling process begun, she was welcomed aboard with all the ceremony due a person of her accomplishments. A formal mold she broke as soon as the proceedings were complete, in favor of cheerful hugs all around. Imagine my surprise when Izumi and I got back to the island and discovered that you hadn't gone home, said Maki to Corwin and Utna as she followed Minami toward her stateroom. You might have said something. We didn't know we weren't yet, said Utna, a little sheepishly. It was kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing. I see, said Maki with a slightly mischievous smile. I'm glad I'm not assigned to protect you. I can see you would be an absolutely maddening VIP. Never sticking to the plan, never keeping your head down, always running toward the danger. I'm afraid she's got you there, Elsker, said Corwin sagely. You're one to talk, trained surfer boy, Utna replied, making Maki laugh. Once the Mirai left Kyoshi Island, the ship's passengers became ever increasingly aware that they were below the tropics now. As the miles clicked ever onward, average temperatures got cooler, the weather a little wilder, the seas a bit rougher. Time on deck became less a balmy spring idyll, indeed, south of the equator it was fall, and more an exercise in exhilaration. Still, there was no complaint from Annabelle, apart from the normal temporary complaints customarily lodged by an infant. Whatever weaknesses she would have in life, it appeared that seasickness would not be among them, any more than it was for any of her parents. 2 days out of Kyoshi Island, they passed by the biggest of the mountainous Patolas, on whose high peak the southern air temple could plainly be seen even from several miles offshore. The Trinity, Korra, Minami, and Maki gathered on the promenade deck, perilously close to being renamed the astronomy deck at this point, to wave, though they were too far to see if anyone was outside, and if anyone had, they presumably wouldn't have been able to see anyone on the passing ship either. Then, the gesture made, they went back inside to have some hot cocoa. The Mirai threaded the Patola Strait that night, and the next morning it was obvious to all aboard that they had well and truly entered the proper southern ocean. The wind was brisk, the sea white-capped, and Korra declared cheerfully that she was back in home waters. "I've got a little surprise for you guys," she told Corwin, Utna, and Anthy at the end of breakfast. A few moments later, when the stewards cleared away the dishes, they replaced them with a trio of neatly wrapped brown paper bundles, one for each. "Aha," said Utna, smiling broadly, as she opened hers and drew out a sturdy, fur-trimmed garment. "I wondered why you told us not to bother buying any winter clothes before we left. Thank you." "Oh my," said Anthy, regarding her own. "These are lovely. Where did you get them?" "Well, the hides came by way of Karana's mom," said Korra, "and I did most of the work myself." She grinned as Utna glanced up in surprise from a closer examination of hers. "What, you didn't think I could sew? Avatar or not, I'm a South Pole girl. Been making my own clothes since I was a kid." "That explains why all your pants that aren't store-bought look exactly the same," Corwin deadpanned, drawing a swat to the back of the head. "What?" he protested. "They do. I didn't say it was a bad thing." Further exploration revealed that each bundle contained a full suite of Water Tribe winter gear, parka, outer trousers, boots, fingered mittens. With the kind of glee usually displayed by children on Christmas, they immediately climbed into the full kit. This left them almost immediately roasting in the heated confines of the dining room, so most of it came back off again, but they kept the parkas on and went out on deck to enjoy the brisk morning in style. Utina's parka was much like Cora's, short and trimly tailored, with three-quarter-length sleeves and white fur trim, but black rather than blue. Though sturdy and warm, it was easy to move in, perfectly cut to accommodate a person who might find herself in a fight. Corwin's, in the traditional Water Tribe blue, was slightly longer and heavier, the garment of a hunter. Anthe's, a dark but rich brickish red, was the most voluminous and elaborately decorated of the three, with stripes of embroidered white Water Tribe knotwork bordering the hood and cuffs, and an intricate beaded fringe at its knee-length hemline. "Sorry the color's a little dull. That's the reddest red I could get without cheating and using synthetic dyes," Cora said apologetically, as Anthe showed one of her sleeves to the baby she held in her other arm.
"Don't be silly, it's beautiful," Anthe told her. "Isn't it, Annabelle?"
"Why does it have two hoods?" wondered Garnet, who stood on Anthe's shoulder looking down at her back. "The inner one's not a hood, it's an amaut," Cora told her. Garnet turned and gave her a puzzled look. "And what's that when it's at home?" "Baby pocket. Fooling around with half a dozen yards of silk is all well and good if you're someplace nice and warm, like Air Temple Island," she added with a wink. "But when you're in the South Pole and you want to secure a baby, you don't have time for all that engineering." So saying, she showed Anthe the proper use of the inner compartment, then demonstrated how the oversized hood behind it could be deployed to cover both of the coat's occupants, or left back to provide a handy second compartment for a chilly-looking lemur. "Aha," said Anthe, smiling. "How very practical." "That's us, hardy, practical folk," said Cora, only semi-sarcastically. "Says so right in the United Republic's Guide to the Rest of the World, or whatever it's officially called. You guys are going to have to improvise a little when it's your turn, I'm afraid," she added to Utina and Corwin as they observed the proceedings with matching little smiles. "Actually, the size she is now, you could just about get away with using your front pockets." Corwin considered the capacious pocket on the front of his parka and remarked wryly, "I could stash two or three babies in here." "Don't even joke," said Utina and Anthe in inadvertent stereo. Then, glancing at each other, they both broke up laughing while Corwin and Garnet gave them dubious sidelong looks and Cora snickered behind a mittened hand. Temperatures continued to fall as the Mirai steamed southward, and the next 2 days shortened markedly as they passed. Presented with the excuse to wear their snazzy new winter wear, none of the Trinity seemed to feel any particular need to take their daily workouts inside, and Cora certainly didn't. But Maki and Minami, objecting that they were native to warmer waters, confined themselves thenceforth to the dojo down on the utility deck. Sunday, April 11th. It was the last evening of the voyage when Anthe first shared her observation of the previous midweek with someone else. They were well into the Southern Ocean by that point, no more than 12 hours out of Nanisivik, and quite by design, not much was happening. Anthe, sitting at one side of the futon in the solarium, was reading a scroll Nima had recommended to advance her understanding of air nomad conflict resolution, and occasionally commenting on elements of it to Annabelle, who, in all honesty, didn't seem as interested as Makoto did. At the other side, Utina and Garnet were puzzling over the rules of the so-called Republic variant of Pai Sho. "Wait, so you can't play a red one if you just played a green one?" Garnet wondered. "I think it depends on the number values," Utina replied. flipping back a few pages in the rulebook. Or not? Play of a red tile of value greater than 5 must be preceded by play of a red or black tile with a value less than 5, except when preceded by an explicit procedural point of order. Oh, not the point of order thing again, said Garnet. I don't get this game at all. She abandoned Utina's shoulder and reported instead to her customary station with Annabelle. Sure, bail out when it gets complicated, Utina joked. There's that can-do dragon spirit. She turned to Anthy, intending to enlist her aid in teasing the young dragon, and saw that she'd lowered the scroll she was studying and was now regarding the office area with a thoughtful expression instead. Utina raised an eyebrow, looked over there herself, saw nothing evidently out of the ordinary, just Corwin and Cora at the design desk, messing around with the configuration of part of the foundation, and turned her attention back to her wife. "What you looking at?" she asked. "Oh, those two at work," said Anthy, nodding toward Sam. Utina looked again. Still nothing particularly arresting going on, as far as she could tell. "Okay. Just watch them for a moment," Anthy advised her. Puzzled but game, Utina settled back against the cushions behind her and engaged her powers of observation. Anthy gave her a minute or so to take in the scene, then prompted quietly, "Does anything you see here seem familiar, my love?" "Is this a trick question?" Utina wondered. "Probably," said Anthy with an impish smile. "Annabelle, your mother's being cryptic at me," said Utina matter-of-factly. "Make her stop." Then she trailed off, her face going still, as it came together for her what Anthy was getting at. At the moment, Cora was standing next to Corwin as he sat at the design desk's console. She was leaning in over his shoulder to examine some fine point of the active diagram he was pointing out with his stylus. In that position, Utina would find placing the flat of her near hand against his back the obvious and natural thing to do. And as she watched, she saw that Cora had evidently thought so too, only she preempted the maneuver at the last moment and diverted her hand to the back of the chair instead. The decision was subtle, almost seamless, and Utina doubted very much whether Cora had been consciously aware that she'd made it, but it stood out like a neon sign to Utina because it was so familiar to her. That sort of decision had been a routine part of her own interactions with Corwin for years. "Oh, hang on, I see what you're getting at," she mused to Anthy. Then, with a shrug, she added casually, "Well, knew this was coming." Anthy blinked, surprised by the matter-of-fact tenor of her husband's response. "You did?" Utina looked at Anthy's slightly puzzled expression and gave a delighted little laugh. "Ha! Did I get someplace before you for once?" To Garnet, she added, "Mark your calendar. You may not see this happen again for years." "I'll make a note," said Garnet drowsily. Considering Utina with a judicious eye, Anthy asked mildly, "What do you think?" "I'm not sure yet," Utina replied, settling back against the cushion behind her as she continued watching the two at work. "Or, well, I know what I think. I'm just not sure what to do about it yet." She spotted a flicker of concern crossing Anthy's face and smiled, reaching over to pat her arm. "I'm not bothered by it, though," she said, then asked rhetorically, "Heck, who knows better than me what that feels like?" Anthy's worried look faded, replaced with a wry little smile of her own as she took Utina's hand. "Indeed," she said. "I just have to give it some thought," Utina went on. "Some
diplomacy may be in order," she added with a little grin and a wink.
"Hmm,"
said Anthy thoughtfully. But without elaborating further, she picked up her scroll and went back to studying it.